less than a month earlier. Hasn't sold gold since the counting house was hit, Lucas said. He's got cash and doesn't need to burn any more gold. What's next? Ray asked. I've got to think about it. Go find Arnold first thing tomorrow. We could do some of that tonight, Ray said. Look at his apartment anyway. Maybe find out where he's working. We could, Lucas yawned. This place has a gym. I'm going to work out first. We could get some dinner and talk about Arnold, whether to go tonight or tomorrow. I might look around for a playground, Ray said. A playground? Bob said to Lucas. She travels with a basketball. She won't let me deflate it. It's the world's biggest pain in the ass. Lucas looked at Ray for a minute, then asked, Where do you play? UConn, Ray said. Starter? Last 2 years, anyway, Ray said. Then, you play? I was hockey at the University of Minnesota, Lucas said. When I was checking out the weight room here, I noticed that this place has a little basketball court. Ray's eyebrows went up. This place does? Yes. I suspect a person of your academic caliber never played any street ball, though, Lucas said. Ray said, With that kind of insight, you could get a detective job in some broke-ass town in the Delta. Lucas, does Bob play? Ray looked at Bob, then back to Lucas. Stumps don't play basketball. Stumps wrestle. I play basketball, Lucas said. Quite well, really. Ray slapped her hands together and stood up, a predatory ivory-white grin slashing her face. 15 minutes on the court. $100 American. 15 minutes later, on the court, Lucas was only a half inch taller than Ray, but he was 60 pounds heavier. Bob found a chair somewhere and sat at the side of the court with a happy smile as he did a running commentary. These people don't like each other. I see the possibility for some really trashy action here, sports fans. It could get ugly. Lucas suspected Ray would be a better shooter than he was, maybe a lot better, but he had the pounds and planned to use them. First rebound, he said. Play to 11, win by 2. You put up the shot, gotta hit the rim. Brace yourself, she said. Ray put up a shot from behind the three-point line with the two of them side by side. If it went in, she'd shoot over until they got a fair rebound on the first shot. The ball came off the right side of the hoop and they both went for it. Lucas gave Ray a hip to move her off the ball, took the rebound, dribbled out of the key, drove straight over her to the basket, scored. With the ball again, he drove over her a second time. The third time she gave him a leg and he almost went down, lost the ball long. She brought it out and Lucas played too far off her and she stepped behind the three-point line and stuffed it, tying at 2-2. That set the game, Lucas playing rough and close, Ray struggling to get free. She had a beautiful stroke and, unless he kept her off balance, deadly. Lucas, sweating heavily, took the lead at 8-7 and held it. At 11-10, he drove hard and with a last-second step to the left made an over-the-head reverse layup and won. 12-10. From the sidelines, Bob shouted, Whoa, whoa, the white boy rallies for the win! Ladies and gentlemen, this was totally unexpected! Ray scowled and said, I got you figured out, white boy. One more game. We gotta talk about Arnold, Lucas said. Oh, now we gotta talk about Arnold. From the sidelines, Bob called, Ladies and gentlemen, is the white boy a pussy? Is he gonna pussy out of the rematch? Did our viewers know that pussy could be both a noun and a verb? One more game, Ray staying well back when she got the ball, running loose until she could shake free, slowing down, taking her time. She killed him, 11-7, and it wasn't that close. I got you figured now, Lucas said, wiping the sweat off his forehead with the bottom of his t-shirt. I'll have a hand inside your nose every time you make a fucking move. Dream on. Bob called. Dinner time, no rubber match. Let's go eat. Lucas and Ray took quick showers, and they all went out to a nearby Italian place that the desk clerk said wasn't too bad, and it wasn't. They were all stinking of garlic bread when Ray said, I'm bored. I say we go after Arnold tonight. I looked it up, Lucas said. His place is over in northeast Dallas, Deisman Drive, rear, about 45 minutes from here. All together or separate cars? Bob asked. How about one of you ride with me and the other bring a backup car? Lucas said. Guy could be a problem with those shotguns, and he might be more of a problem if he's still hanging with Poole and is worried about it, Bob said. How about if Ray rides with you, takes her M4 with her, and I bring my own? That way, we got some clout in both cars. That was good with Lucas. Ray got her gun and a vest and brought them over to Lucas's Jeep. As they were getting ready to move, Bob came over and said, I talked to my guy at the Dallas cops to tell them that we'll be around. They're cool with it. Lucas said, I haven't done much of this Marshall stuff. What would be their options if they weren't cool with it? Ray said, Well, somebody in the neighborhood could call them and tell them there's a tall black person with a machine gun and armor in their front yard, send help, and the cops could flood the place with 15 or 20 squads and the SWAT team and kill everybody they don't recognize. Lucas said, The Dallas cops are supposed to be pretty good. They are pretty good, Bob said. But you know, the way things are right now... Good move, Bob, Lucas said. Let's keep them informed. The night had come down hard by the time they found Deisman Drive. They were hooked up with Ray's cell phone on speaker and cruised the house twice. There were two structures on the lot, a small 50s-looking house with an aging gray Pontiac in the driveway and what might once have been a garage or studio in back. Both places showed lights. The front house had a metal stake in the side yard with a circular path around it. A dog, and probably a protective one, though there was no dog in sight. Gotta watch for the dog, Ray said into her phone. I saw that, Bob called back. Probably ought to stop at the place in front before we go around back. They did that. Sitting in front of the target house for a few minutes, windows down, listening to an unidentifiable television drama leaking through the windows of the house in front. Crickets. After watching for a few minutes, Lucas called Bob and said, Ray and I'll knock. Got you covered, Bob said. If you start running, I'll be ready to hose the place down, so don't start running unless you're serious, Lucas said. I'll leave my phone on so you can hear it all, Lucas asked Ray. You set? Got my hand in my purse, she said. I'll leave the M4 for now. The purse was actually a holster purse and contained her Glock. Let's go. The door at the front house was open, as were the windows, though all the openings were tightly screened. Lucas knocked, and a woman's voice said, Somebody at the door, Mitch. Somebody at the door. A moment later, a fat, balding man in shorts, t-shirt, and bare feet peered through the screen at Lucas and Ray and asked, Who the heck are you? Lucas held up his badge and said, Federal Marshals, we want to talk. The man said, Bullshit. I'm calling the cops, and slammed the inner door. Through the screened windows, they heard a woman ask, Mitch, who was it, Mitch? And Mitch said, Some fake cops. I'm calling 911. Lucas had his cell phone on, turned to the speakerphone, and Bob said, I heard that. I'll call 911 and get back to you when it's straightened out. Lucas stood on the porch, and Ray stood back at an angle. A woman peered out of one of the screened windows and said, "If you're fake, you better go away. The cops are gonna be coming." "We're federal marshals, so the cops are already here, as your husband will probably find out in a minute or so," Ray told her. The woman said, "Oh," and looked back to where her husband was on the phone. "I think they might be real, Mitch." Lucas's phone buzzed, and Bob said, "We're clear with 911. A minute later, Mitch came to the door, red-faced and apologetic, and said, "Sorry about that. We've had some problems in the neighborhood. Got my mail stolen last month." "By a tall white guy wearing a suit in the middle of the night?" Ray asked from behind Lucas's shoulder. "It's okay," Lucas said, patching things over. "Sorry if we startled you. We need to ask about the man who lives in the back." "Deedee? What'd he do?" His wife had moved up to his shoulder and muttered, "I told you he was trouble." "He hasn't done anything as far as we know," Lucas said. "We're asking about an old friend of his." Mitch said, "Well, he's back there. Feel free." "Has he been any trouble with the law that you know of? Or any trouble at all?" Ray asked. Mitch shook his head. "We don't see him that much. He works at a gentleman's club during the day. Sometimes he's got a girl who stays over. Most of the time he's back there alone with his bird."
"His bird?"
"Yeah, you know, he's got a bird. It's like a parrot, sort of," Mitch said.
"Cockatoo," the woman said. "Real pretty. All white.
He calls it Angel. It does look like an angel. A small one."
"Don't call him and tell him we're here," Lucas said. "Sure won't," the man said.
The house in back showed light at three windows. Two of the windows were closed, and the third was occupied by a humming window air conditioner. Through the closed door, they could hear Florida Georgia Line's "Get Your Shine On" played loud. Lucas pushed the doorbell. When there was no answer, he said, "Music's too loud," and banged on the door with his fist. The music was turned down, and a minute later a man in a sleeveless shirt, shorts, and flip-flops came to the door. His upper body was the size of a garbage can, and not all of it was fat, though some of it was. He squinted nearsightedly at Lucas, then at Ray.
"Who are you?"
Lucas's badge again. "Federal marshals."
"Why? I haven't done nothing,"
the large man said, though a thin trail of marijuana smoke had accompanied him to the door.
"We need to ask you about an old friend of yours," Ray said. "So we're coming in."
"You got a search warrant?"
Ray shook her head.
"I hate to tell you this, Deedee, but smoking weed is still a federal crime, and from where we're at, we can smell it."
"You gotta be kidding me."
"No, we're not," Lucas said. "We need to talk, so we're coming in. If you want to stand back..."
Arnold stepped back, and Lucas and Ray moved inside. The house was like a hunting shack. One big room with a bed in a corner, a dinette kitchen, and a clothes rack covering one end of the place. There were two enclosed spaces, a tiny bathroom, and a floor-to-ceiling wire cage in which a cockatoo sat on a tree branch. The cockatoo peered at them and said,
"Unc Gertie."
The place smelled heavily of Campbell's Chunky Hearty bean with ham soup, a touch of the consequent flatulence, with a subtle overtone of newspaper and bird shit. Two overstuffed chairs faced a TV, and an electric guitar was parked in a corner with a bright orange lunchbox-sized amp. The guitar had a psychedelic twisted black-and-white checkerboard inlaid on the top. Lucas pointed at one of the chairs and said,
"Sit."
Arnold sat and asked,
"What the heck is going on, man? I've been clean forever."
"Except for the weed," Ray said.
"It's medicinal," Arnold said. "I'm in the compassionate use program."
"We're talking federal," Ray said.
We don't care what the law says in Baja, Oklahoma.
Everybody calm down, Lucas said. He took the chair next to Arnold, crossed his legs, and said, We need some help. We didn't come to bust you on the weed.
What kind of help? Arnold asked.
When was the last time you saw Garvin Poole?
Oh, shit, Arnold said.
He looked at Angel, which clucked a couple of times and said again,
Unc Gertie.
Back to Lucas.
Man, I ain't seen Gar in 6 or 7 years. I don't got any idea where he might be. He'd do something lately.
For one thing, he moved to Dallas, Lucas said. Since you're right here, Arnold was shaking his head.
Man, if he's in Dallas, that's news to me. I don't want nothing to do with him.
The last time I seen him, he didn't actually see me. I walked into this bar in Jackson, Mississippi, and Gar was sitting in with the band. He had a beard, but I knew it was him. I snuck out the back door and took off. That was, like I said, 6 or 7 years ago.
I'm not sure I 100% believe you, Lucas said. We've heard you two were tight.
We were tight for a while. Gar and some other guys were providing protection for some dope dealers, and I was working for them and got busted for it. But anyway, that's when I got to know Gar. We both played a little guitar, and we both liked the music. We'd jam a little bit.
Didn't know he was musical, Ray said.
He can play country. You know, he builds guitars. He built mine. They're called parts casters because he makes them up from commercial parts, but then he decorates the body, you know, the soundboard and the headstock. He does some custom inlay on the fretboard.
Lucas, he does it commercially? He has a website or something?
Arnold shrugged.
Don't know anymore. Back when I knew him, he used to do it like a hobby. He'd sell them, got some good money for them, too. But it was all word of mouth. You had to know him to get one.
It's like a talent, Ray said.
Like his talent with guns.
Yeah, like a talent, Arnold agreed. I'll tell you, though, I never worked with him. He had this reputation. People who worked with him, they died, got killed. He supposedly killed some of them, and some other ones, well, Gar would pull some crazy fucking stick up and wind up shooting it out with somebody. I didn't want anything to do with that shit. My idea of a perfect crime is getting a rub from one of the girls at the club.
You had a reputation for carrying a shotgun, Lucas said. The shrug again.
Listen, guys, when you did what I did, you were expected to carry a shotgun. It was like a lawyer with a briefcase or a cop with a pistol. But I wasn't gonna get in any big shootouts. If the cops showed up while I was working, my plan was to throw the shotgun in the ocean and give up. No fucking way I wanted to fight the DEA. Those guys got bazookas and damn little mercy.
Lucas's phone rang. Bob calling.
I think we're okay in here, Lucas said.
Want me to come in?
Lucas looked at Arnold.
Nah, we'll be out in 5 minutes. We got a possible felony here, but we're talking.
Lucas got off the phone, and Arnold, sweating, said,
Man, it's not a felony. I haven't even got an ounce.
We need you to check with your friends. Find out where Poole might be, Lucas said. We need to hear from you.
If I did that, somebody would come here and kill me, Arnold said.
Not if Poole's in prison.
It's more than just Poole, Arnold said. It's that whole gang he ran with.
Like Sturgill Darling? Arnold's forehead wrinkled.
Who?
They talked for another 5 minutes, and when they left, Lucas was fairly convinced that Arnold was a dry hole. As they were going out the door, Ray said,
If you told us one lie, we'll be right back in your face.
I believe you, baby girl, Arnold said.
Ray stopped.
Say what?
Ma'am,
Arnold said.
On the way back to the hotel, Ray said, I looked you up on the internet after I beat you up this afternoon. I wanted to look up your hockey career. Couldn't find much about it.
I was a defenseman back before the internet. When I got ink, it was actually ink. You won't find it online, Lucas said. If a guy from back then gets on the internet, he's either a big-time shooter who went pro or he's put it on himself. Anyway, I saw all that other stuff on you. Said you're rich, Ray said.
I'm well off, Lucas said. Internet said you were really, really rich, Ray said.
I don't think of myself that way. I'm a middle-class cop who got lucky, Lucas said.
This is like a sport for you? Chasing these people down?
No, it's what I do. Having the money is really nice. If I didn't have any money, I'd still do this. She nodded.
Okay.
At the hotel, Lucas said goodnight to the other two. Think about it. How do we find our needle in the haystack?
I'll do that, Bob said. He laughed and said, Never heard anything like that bird, I gotta tell you.
Ray and Lucas looked at each other, and Ray said, Huh? Bob looked from one to the other and said,
You must have heard it.
Heard it squawk, Lucas said.
Wasn't squawking, Bob said. Maybe you could hear it better over the phone. It was saying, not guilty.
Ray, no.
Yes,
Lucas shook his head.
Good night. Don't wake me up too early.
When Derek Arnold was sure that Lucas and Ray were gone for good, he kissed his bird goodbye and walked out to the gentleman's club where he worked his day job. The on-duty bartender asked,
What the hell you doing here this late?
Can't stay away, it's the tits, Arnold said. He walked around behind the bar, pulled a beer for himself, and then walked past the topless dancers in the half-glass dancing booth without giving them a glance. After you've seen the first 10 or 20,000 tits, you've seen them all. Past the VIP areas where the chumps got lap dances, past the elevators to the playpens, where well-connected athletes and entertainers got more than their laps danced, past the restrooms to the kitchen. In the kitchen, he nodded to a waiter and dug around in the junk drawer, found the prepaid phone card, and carried it out in the hall to the emergency exit and the payphone installed there, inside the door. At the phone, he punched in the number for the prepaid card and then the number he had for Garvin Poole. The phone rang 4 times before a woman answered.
Yeah?
Cool voice with a little whiskey in it.
Is Gar there?
A moment of silence, then,
Who's this?
A guy he gave this number to? I used to unload. Don't want to say names.
Wait one.
A moment later, Poole came on and asked, Unload where?
Galveston. One time we yanked about 20 pounds of weed out of a bundle and pushed it down our pants. My balls smelled like dope for a week.
Gotcha,
Poole said, laughing at the memory.
What's up, man?
A federal marshal came by my house tonight. He thinks you're in Dallas, but he doesn't know where. They came after me because I'm living in Dallas, too.
I didn't know that, Poole said. Where you at?
Got a place over in northeast Dallas, Arnold said. Rather not say the address on the phone.
You say anything to them?
Of course not. For one thing, I don't know anything but this phone number, Arnold said. I don't even know that they're right, that you're here in Dallas. I thought you were still in Mississippi. I can't tell you much except that they're here and they're looking hard. They think you were involved in some kind of dope robbery.
Another moment of silence.
You think they have any specific idea of where I'm at? I'm pretty sure they don't. That's what they wanted from me. They didn't say why they were here or why they thought you were here. They didn't give me much at all. More silence. Okay. Thanks, man. I owe you. I'll send you a few bucks your way when I get a chance.
How will I get in touch? Don't say your number on the phone.
My dad's got a number, if you remember him, Arnold said.
I do. Still working oil?
Yep. Retires next year. Give him a call if you need to get in touch, Arnold said.
Thanks again,
Poole said. He sounded like he meant it, and he was gone. Chapter 14
Lucas was in a deep sleep when somebody began pounding on his door. He sat up, blinking, saw a streetlight through a crack in the curtain, still dark outside. He'd turned the overly bright clock away from him, and as the pounding started again, turned the clock and saw that it was 6:12.
Coming, he called, thinking, fire?
He looked through the peephole and saw Bob, and Bob did not look happy. He looked frantic. Lucas opened the door and asked,
what?
The words sputtered out. Got a call from the Dallas cops 1 minute ago. Somebody chopped Arnold up, he's like fish bait, and killed Mitch and his wife, whatever her name was.
What?
Bob started to repeat himself, but Lucas waved him off and said,
I got it. Let's get over there. You wake Ray up?
That's next.
Meet you in the lobby in 5, Lucas said.
Make it 10. I want to brush my teeth, and I gotta get my gear out of here. I'll get Ray moving. She's pretty quick.
As Bob trotted off down the hallway, Lucas noticed that he seemed to be wearing nothing but a pair of thigh-length underpants and a T-shirt. No shoes. Lucas went back inside, cleaned up, and was out of the room 12 minutes after Bob trotted away. Bob got to the lobby at the same time he did, carrying the oversized bag that he used for the ordnance, and Ray showed up 2 minutes later, trying to get on some lipstick as she walked.
This is fucking crazy, she said. We all going together? We need to figure this out before we talk to the cops.
Your car's the biggest, Bob said to Lucas.
The drug guys found Arnold, Lucas said as they walked out to the parking lot. The day before had been hot, but the pre-dawn air had a sharpness to it. Autumn coming to Texas. They've got to have a source somewhere. It seems to me the only way they could go straight to Arnold is if they knew we were talking to him.
Walk me through that, Ray said.
If you work through the sheets on Garvin Poole, you'll come up with a lot of names of people who've been associated with him. Arnold is one of the more obscure. The only reason we went for him, the only reason we came here, is because Sturgill Darling made a phone call to Dallas. We weren't even sure that Poole was here until we went to the gold stores. That's when we decided to go to Arnold. How are a couple of thugs going to figure that out? Only one way. They have a source who told them what we're doing.
Where's the source? Ray asked. In the Marshal's service? How many people in the service knew we were going to see Arnold?
I didn't tell anyone, Lucas said. I told my guy about the phone call by Darling, and he switched me over to a woman named Mary who takes care of travel. I told my chief at SOG and asked him if he knew Arnold.
He didn't, Bob said.
I'd trust him with my life. Hell, me and Ray both have.
Ray, maybe the Dallas cops?
Can't be the cops. I didn't talk to them until yesterday evening, Bob said. If these two were up in Nashville, I mean, how'd they get here so fast? How would anyone in Dallas even know to tell them?
Ray said, it'd have to be somebody in the service who's not waiting for them to call. Somebody who's looking at the same reports Lucas has who could call them directly. Might even be running them.
That sucks, Bob said.
They were driving across town with the first dawn light, but the freeways were already getting stiff. The sun was up by the time they walked past the police lines around Arnold's place. Dallas crime scene people were already working in the two houses and the yard, and a cop wearing corporal's stripes directed them toward a man in civilian clothes.
"Lieutenant Hart, he's in charge."
Donald Hart was a tall, tough-looking black man who gave Ray a long look as they walked up.
"You the feds?"
Lucas nodded. "Yeah. Anyone tell you what we're doing?"
"Not entirely. I got jerked out of bed an hour ago. I don't get that many triples, and when we do, they don't look like this one. What the hell are we into here?"
Hart leaned back against the fender of a squad car as Lucas introduced Bob and Ray and then briefed him. When Lucas finished, Hart said,
"The killers are professionals. No tie to anything local."
"I don't believe so," Lucas said. "I can tell you for sure if I can take a look inside Arnold's place."
"That makes sense that they're professionals. I thought they might be. I'll tell you about that in a minute. I'm not, sure. How much do you guys deal with homicides?"
"I spent 25 years chasing homicides up in Minneapolis and all over Minnesota before I joined the Marshal Service," Lucas said. "Altogether, probably worked 300 of them, either as the lead investigator or assisting." Hart nodded.
"Good. Sometimes we get federals down here who get a little pukey when they see a dead one."
"People we deal with, we get a little pukey with the live ones," Bob said.
"Dead ones don't bother us much."
"Come on, then," Hart said.
Hart said the couple in the front house were Mitch and Carla Bennett. They'd been made to lie down on the front room carpet, and each had been shot in the back of the head with a large-caliber weapon. Lucas told Hart that when they'd visited the night before, the windows had been open. They were closed now, and Lucas suggested that the crime scene crew print the window frames where somebody would have pushed them down.
"We'll do that. Most of the places around here would have had air conditioning, so nobody heard any shots. Or any screaming, for that matter. They took their time with Arnold," Hart said. "The thing that had us wondering about the headshots is that they didn't go through. Big hole in the back of their heads, but no exit wound. That said to me that they were using low-power cartridges, maybe 45s with very light loads. Not much noise," Bob said.
"Professionals. Rolling their own."
Hart nodded.
"I thought that might be the situation, but didn't know who or why until you guys showed up."
Arnold was a mess. His legs were taped with gaffer's tape, tough fibrous stuff that he wouldn't have been able to rip off, even with all the power in his heavily muscled arms and legs. There was no tape around his mouth, but traces of tape adhesives. After they bound him, they gagged him and then began torturing him with saws and what might have been a propane torch. Both of his legs had been partially severed below the knee, and his genitals had been burned off. When they were done with him, they'd fired a single round through his forehead. They hadn't touched the bird, which shuffled silently back and forth on its perch, Arnold's tiny angel looking at a little piece of hell. Lucas looked over the scene, turned to Bob and Ray. They both nodded, and Lucas said to Hart,
"It's the same, too. I can't tell you who the shooter is, but the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation has identikit pictures of the woman. Pretty good ones."
"Motherfuckers," Bob said. "Don't quote me, but they desperately need to be shot."
"Nobody gonna argue with that," Hart said.
Lucas asked, "Do you have a time on this?"
"The crew says probably about 4 in the morning, give or take. The blood wasn't completely dry, and they can tell by the stickiness, I guess, about how long it's been pooled there."
Ray said to Lucas,
"If they knew we were flying down to Dallas, if they knew about the time the tickets were bought,
They'd have time to drive here. I don't think they would have flown with specialty weapons like that 45, and you said they shot you up with an automatic weapon.
Makes them harder to find, too, Bob said. If they'd flown, we might be able to find a rental car.
Lucas said to Hart, We'll leave this with you, Don. There's nothing here for us. We'll coordinate with you. The main thing we need to figure out is where the leak is. Somebody had to tell them exactly where we were going, tell them about Arnold, and give them the address.
Then Lucas stepped through the door. Outside, cupped his mouth and nose in his hands, stood with his face looking down toward his shoes. He muttered, Holy fuck.
Ray, behind him, asked, What?
Lucas walked a circle around the yard, head down, Bob, Ray, and Hart looking at him. When he got back, he said to Bob and Ray,
It's us. We told them. No, wait. I told them.
Bob. What?
Lucas looked up now. Listen, we know they've got a line into law enforcement files. That's the only way they could have started tracking Poole. But an inside source wouldn't know what we're doing, not minute by minute. Bob told his SOG guy about Arnold, but says that guy wouldn't talk.
He wouldn't, Bob said. I've known him for 15 years. He would not.
Lucas. But if they have a hacker... If they have a hacker, and he's a good one, I mean, I know a guy up in Minnesota who can pull files out of the NCIS all day long, who can look at Verizon computers anytime he wants. There might be a lot of guys who can do that. They've got one. Somewhere along the line, they identified me, maybe saw my license plate number. They've been following my phone, like I tracked Steiner down to Florida.
Son of a bitch, Bob said.
That sounds kind of far-fetched, Hart said.
Doesn't to me,
Ray said. Think about all the files that have been hacked during the presidential campaign and how high up the hackers got. Seems like everybody can hack everybody. You just gotta know the right hacker. With the way things are now, a drug cartel is gonna have hackers, maybe a lot of them.
What are you going to do? Hart asked Lucas. If you're right, you gotta get rid of your phone first thing.
Lucas's hands were still cupped across his mouth, still head down.
Can't help the Bennetts or Arnold, he said, but I'm not getting rid of my phone. We can still use it.
Bob.
We're gonna suck them in.
That's what we're gonna do, Lucas said, lifting his head. I'm gonna kill the motherfuckers.
They found a Best Buy off Highway 75. Lucas and Bob left their phones in the Jeep, and Ray drove it away. A half hour later, she was back for a flying pickup, and Lucas and Bob gave her a new burner phone, identical to the ones they'd bought. They thought the killers had probably tracked Lucas, but decided not to take a chance. Maybe they'd tagged Bob or Ray.
Now what?
Now we find a nice, improbable, and semi-trashy place for us to go, not too far from the hotel, and we spend some time there like we did with Arnold. Then one of us drives the Jeep back to the hotel with our regular phones inside, leaves the phones at the hotel, and drives back. We're gonna ambush their asses, Ray said to Bob.
I do like the way he thinks.
Ray was still driving, and Lucas used his iPad to look over the Dallas area and decided to check the town of Addison, which appeared to be a highly mixed commercial industrial town built around a general aviation airport and not too far from the hotel. Ray took the Jeep that way, and they eventually spotted a townhouse complex surrounded by narrow lawns on all four sides, and a wraparound parking lot that was mostly empty. The front of the complex faced the concrete backside of a truck terminal. Two other concrete-faced commercial buildings stood at opposite ends of the street. If there should be any shooting,
It would be as safe outside the complex as anywhere they'd seen. They cruised the neighborhood a couple of times, talking about possible setups, and then headed back to the hotel.
"One thing we've got to talk about. Do we tell the Addison cops what we're doing?" Ray asked.
"If we're setting up to ambush a couple of killers in their town, they might be a little nervous and maybe even a little pissed. If we had any other options," Bob said. "The usual unwarranted aversion to bullets flying around."
"Lucas, I know you federal guys, us federal guys, like to bring the locals in whenever possible. This might be an exception. We've got a safe spot to make a stop, and we're going to have to make a stop somewhere."
"Your call," Ray said.
Lucas thought about it, then said, "Fuck it. Let's tell Addison we're doing surveillance down here and ask them not to cruise the area. If it all goes up in smoke, at least we'll have that for cover, you know, that we called them in advance."
"Sneaky," Bob said.
At the hotel, they moved some of Bob's armory around. Lucas got a heavy-duty vest, and Ray and Bob carried M4s, ammo, and vests to their separate cars. Lucas carried a battery-operated Altec miniature speaker out to his car. A quick stop at a Subway got them sandwiches and bottles of water and Diet Coke for Lucas, and a second stop got them magazines and newspapers, and then they headed back to the townhouses. Once there, Lucas and Ray parked at opposite ends of the front parking lot, and Bob parked in back. Lucas hooked up the tiny Bluetooth speaker to the iPad, picked out a decent playlist, and settled in to wait. Bob called his boss at SOG, told him what was happening, then called the Addison cops, got the chief, identified himself, told him about the surveillance, and asked that patrol cars not cruise the neighborhood too heavily. He gave his SOG boss as a reference. Lucas called Fort, his contact in Washington, told him the same thing. Then he called Ray, and Ray called Bob to further establish their location if somebody was monitoring them. 2 hours after they made the parking lot, Lucas called Bob and said, "Come get the phones."
"On the way," Bob said.
Bob collected Lucas's and Ray's phones, drove them back to the hotel, then made calls on each of them, to Washington and back to the SOG headquarters. That done, he left the phones at the motel and drove back to the apartment and set up at his previous spot, and called Lucas and Ray on the burner phones.
"We're set," he told Lucas.
"Could be a long wait," Lucas said.
"Be worth it to take these sons of bitches down," Bob said. "What they did to Arnold."
Chapter 15. The college-sounding guy had spotted Lucas flying out of Nashville for Dallas. As they were leaving to follow by car, Court stole a couple of pillows from a Holiday Inn linen closet left open by the cleaning crew. Her ass felt like it was on fire, and when she pressed on the wounds with toilet paper, she was getting some nasty-looking fluid.
"Might have an infection,"
Soto had said. He sounded like he didn't care, because he didn't.
"Hurts like hell," Court had groaned. "I'm going to Dallas flat on my stomach. 10 fucking hours."
"Better get some pillows or something,"
Soto had said. She'd done that, and Soto had hauled their suitcases out to the latest rental, a Chevy Tahoe from National. The thing should cost an arm and a leg, but since they were using a phony credit card and ID and wouldn't be returning it, the cost didn't matter, and Court could lie mostly flat in the back. Soto made one last trip inside and came back carrying a bottle of gin, partially wrapped in a towel.
"What's that for?" Court asked.
"Give me your hand,"
Soto said. Without thinking, she stuck her hand out, and Soto grabbed it and pulled it toward him.
At the same time, he lifted the gin bottle, which she now saw had been broken off about halfway down, and jabbed the sharp broken edge into her forearm. She managed to stifle a scream, but threw herself away from him, farther into the folded-down back seat, looked down at her bleeding arm, and cried, "What the fuck?"
"Now you need to go to the emergency room and get sewed up," Soto said.
And he climbed into the driver's seat. He handed her the towel and said,
"Wrap this around it. Don't get blood all over the car. It'll start smelling bad."
"What the hell are you doing?"
"What happened was, you slammed the motel medicine cabinet door too hard and the mirror broke and cut your arm. Medicine cabinet looked dirty to you. You're afraid you're going to be infected. That's why I drove you to the emergency room."
"Emergency room?" At the emergency room, a nurse practitioner put a half dozen self-dissolving stitches in her arm, took the same credit card they'd used to rent the Tahoe, and sent them on their way with prescriptions for antiseptic cream, penicillin pills, and pain pills. They filled the prescriptions at a Walgreens and headed for Texas.
"Could have thought of a better way to do it," Court grumbled from the back seat.
The pain pills made her more comfortable, and her arm had not hurt that bad to begin with. The penicillin pills, she thought, might even cure her aching ass.
"Don't bother to say thanks,"
Soto squeaked at her, and she didn't. That night, as they crossed the Red River, the college-sounding guy called and said, "That Davenport dude spent an hour out in a Dallas neighborhood. He was at a house in northeast Dallas. Actually, there are two houses. I don't know this for sure, but I think he went into both of them."
"You got an address?"
Soto asked. "I not only got an address, I can get you a picture of the place. Give me a few hours, I might be able to get you names from the gas company, run them to see who they go to. Davenport's staying in a hotel over toward Fort Worth." 2 hours later, he called again. "The people in the front house, the house closest to the street, are named Bennett, and I don't find any association with Poole, but they could be Poole and his girlfriend, since Poole's probably using a phony name. Now, the guy in the back, that's a different story. He was definitely involved with Poole in the past."
"How do you know that?" Court demanded.
"Everything is data now," the college-sounding guy said. "Give me your real names and I'll tell you your bank balance and what hour you were born."
"I don't need to know when I was born, because I already know that," Soto said. "What I need is another car when we get to Dallas. Find one for me."
As Lucas, Bob, and Ray were flying into Dallas, and Court and Soto headed southwest toward Dallas, Sturgill Darling showed up at Poole's place. He, Poole, and Box sat in Poole's living room, talking.
"I'm not quitting the farm. That's my home, and I'm not leaving," he told Poole. "When I get out of here, I'm going up to Canada. Shoot me a bear, build an alibi, and then head back home as innocent as one of the Lord's angels. I gotta believe they'll be all over me, though. It's gonna be a grind getting through it."
"I'm not sure what you're doing here," Box said.
"We got two problems. The feds aren't going away, but they don't know about me. Not really. Not the way they know about you guys." Darling nodded at Poole and Box. "If they put your faces on TV, I might be able to do things you can't. The other problem is these cartel killers. I don't know how they got onto us, but they are. We need to get them off our backs, and I know something that you don't."
"What's that?" Poole asked.
"I know where they come from. I know who they work for. I got a phone number. Knowing that, we might be able to figure out a way to set them up, wipe them out. I can't rest easy knowing that they're looking at my farm, at me and my wife."
"Wipe them out and they'll send two more," Poole said.
"Maybe.
And maybe not. Maybe they'll cut their losses, especially if we tip the feds as to who's running them. We've got to get rid of these two first thing. After that, well, you'll be hit again, and I'll spend $100,000 putting a security system around the farm. Radar, the whole works. Best I can do. Poole nodded. I buy all that. Box. So do I. What they did to Gar's folks, they're nuts. How do we get this going? Poole asked. Make a long-distance phone call to Honduras, Darling said. I'd have to think about that, Poole said. They haven't gotten to anybody who knows where we're at. Not yet. Dallas is a big place. They talked about it during the evening, and Box went out to a Whole Foods and got some ribs and organic sweet corn, and they barbecued in the backyard, talking about everything and nothing, and working through it. Late that evening, Arnold called. Box answered and then handed the phone to Poole. When Poole got off, he said, "The feds are here." "Darling, here in Dallas?" "Yeah. You remember Derek Arnold? Dee-Dee?" "Didn't know him, but heard the name." "That was him on the phone. He's here in Dallas, too," Poole said. "I didn't know that, and he didn't know that I was, but the feds paid him a visit. Names were Davenport, Givens, and something else. Federal marshals. Davenport's the guy who shot up the drug guys at the farm," Darling said. "I heard him introduce himself to Janice. She estimates that he's not somebody you want to fool with." "Gotta get out," Buck said. "Gar, we gotta go. Real soon." "I think so," Poole said. "Tomorrow morning." "How about calling Honduras?" Darling asked. "We could feed them Arnold, and when they show up at his place, take two assholes off the plate." "Let's keep hold of the idea, but if we're getting out and they don't know where we're going, then they're back to square one. And how can they know where we're going if we don't?" Poole and Box got up early the next morning, both a little groggy, and found Darling sitting in a chair in the backyard smoking a cigarette. "Those will kill you faster than the feds," Box said. She and Poole came out and took chairs. "Only smoke one a day," Darling said. "That's okay, then. Don't see how you do it, though," Buck said. "If I smoked one, I'd smoke 39 more." They decided to move whatever they could, the really valuable stuff, to a secure storage unit. "Can't do anything about the furniture," Buck said. She was bummed by the evacuation of their house, the first house she had lived in that she actually liked. She had bought the furniture herself with the help of an Ethan Allen design consultant and still got a little thrill looking at it, like something from a Sunday newspaper magazine. "Even if we had time, there'd be moving people who'd know where we put it, and people in the neighborhood who'd know what movers we used. We could get ambushed if we ever tried to pick it up," Poole said. "Yeah, I know," she said, "but I love the stuff." "We'll get more stuff when we get to wherever we're going," Poole said. "Better stuff." They had four vehicles, an Audi A5 convertible for Box, a Mustang for Poole, and a Ford F-150 pickup, plus Darling's pickup. Poole had shied away from the idea of a flashy car when they first got to Texas, but didn't take long to figure out that flashy cars in Dallas were like Kias in Jackson, and he did like fast cars. This morning, though, he went back and forth to the pickup, loading up tools and guitars from the workshop, computers, televisions, stereo equipment, guns, silverware, dishes, all crammed into U-Haul boxes as fast as Box and Darling could do it. Arnold had told Poole on the phone the night before that the feds didn't actually know their specific address,
only that they were in Dallas. Arnold didn't know how they knew that. They must have some kind of source. Poole, Darling, and Box thought they had some time, though it was impossible to tell how much. It would be best to get out as soon as they could. They'd store the Mustang and the F-150, Poole decided, until they could come back and retrieve them. Box would take her convertible because a single woman in a convertible looked harmless, and Poole would ride with Darling because nobody was looking for Darling in Texas, as far as they knew. They were done packing up the valuable stuff by mid-morning and still had more room in the storage unit, so Box got them to take over a dining room table with chairs, the bedstand, a bureau and mirror, and two big chests of drawers. That was it. That was all the place would take. They moved the Mustang and the F-150 into separate units, and then Poole and Darling went into the management office and paid cash for 2 years' storage. While the owner was writing out a receipt, they got 10% off for the cash, because the owner didn't plan to pay taxes on it, and everybody knew it. Darling was looking up at an overhead TV and bumped Poole with his elbow. Poole looked up at the TV screen, which showed a bunch of cops and lots of yellow crime scene tape around a house in northeast Dallas. A female newscaster was saying, in a voiceover, "Unofficial police reports say that two people were executed in the Bennett house and that the man in the rear house was tortured to death." The owner had finished with the receipt and looked up and said, "You hear about that? Some guy got all chopped to pieces by some fruitcakes." Outside, Darling said to Poole, "I think that was Arnold. One of the cops on the TV looked like that Davenport guy who came to my place. I'm pretty sure it was him." "If it's the cartel guys, and that's Arnold's place, and if Arnold gave them my phone number, and if they have a way to trace it..." "Gotta move," Darling said. They got back to the house 15 minutes later, and they were gone in 30, with no solid plan. They headed north on I-35E to Denton and rendezvoused at the Golden Triangle Mall at a freestanding Starbucks. They got muffins and coffee. The place was crowded inside, but the outside tables were empty, and they took one in the sunshine. Box had brought her Mac Air from the car. "They got Wi-Fi here. Let me get online and see what I can find out about those killings down in Dallas," she said. A minute or so after she got online, she said, "Shit, Fox 4 is identifying the tortured man as Derek Donald Arnold. Says he works at the T-Bar, a gentleman's club, and has an arrest record for assault and a variety of drug charges." "Now we know for sure," Darling said. "But we got a complication with that marshal being here." "Not a complication anymore," Poole said. "Maybe they'll all find our house, but they won't find us." Buck sniffed.
"I really like that place. I was thinking we might get a cat."
The two men looked at her, and then Poole chuckled.
"I guess we could. We could still do that. We need a place to settle in."
40 miles to the south, Soto knocked on Court's motel room door. They'd been up until 5 o'clock in the morning and had slept past noon. Court let him in, and Soto asked, first thing,
"How's your ass?"
"Some better," she said. She walked back and lay belly down on the bed, cranking her head up on a pillow so she could see him. "Still hurts, but I'm not getting any more of the juice out of the holes. I think the penicillin is working."
"Can you drive?"
"If I have to," she said. "Still got a dozen pain pills." Soto nodded.
"I'm going to get the other car. You can wait here until I get back with it."
"What's going on?"
"The college-sounding guy has another place for us to check. A row of rental townhouses," Soto said. 40 of them. Davenport was there for almost 2 hours, up at the west end of the place. But we don't know exactly which one.
We got a name?
We got a bunch of names. The college-sounding guy got them from the gas company. Two of the renters have drug busts. Another guy's been up on assault. They might be guys we want to look at. But the main thing is there's a live-in manager, and I'll bet Davenport talked to him. We get to that guy, and we'll have some idea of what was going on.
Think he'll talk? Court asked.
I wasn't planning to ask him nice,
Soto said. Sounds funky.
It is, but it's all I can think to do, Soto said. You don't have to come in with me. I want the extra car there in case of trouble.
You're expecting trouble?
No, but it's the same deal every time, dumbass. Two cars, if there's any way to do it. Already saved us once on this trip.
What if Davenport found Poole and arrested him? If he was there for 2 hours, that's a long time.
Soto was shaking his head. He went from the townhouses straight back to his hotel. There wasn't any arrest. And he was there for a long time, which makes it more interesting. And then the boss is getting antsy.
Court, he called you?
Yeah, wanted a full report. I had to tell him about your ass. He's really unhappy about that. Says you probably left some DNA behind, so if you ever get looked at, they'll know you're the tool queen. Then they'll put some real pressure on you and you'll spill your guts.
Wouldn't do that, Court said.
Course you would. Never heard of anyone who wouldn't, if the choice was that or the needle, Soto said.
Including you? Court asked.
Fuck you, Soto said,
and a moment later,
yeah, including me. I met a guy in the joint down in Florida who was on death row for 6 years, and then they called it off and gave him life instead. He said when he was on the row, he'd sit there in his cell and imagine getting strapped into the chair. They still had the chair back then, knowing that it's coming. Day after day, thinking about it, dawn to dark, getting closer and closer, says in the end he would have said anything they wanted to get out of it.
Court thought about that for a moment, then pushed herself up off the bed and said, okay, let's get it over with.
We didn't get shit from Arnold.
We gotta do something. Chapter 16. The townhouse complex was made up of 42 separate houses in 6 brown brick buildings, 2 ranks of 3 buildings each. The backs of the buildings faced each other across a rectangle of brown grass with 3 neglected swing sets and a large dirt square that might once have been a swimming pool. Each building had a parking lot out front, and the lots were connected by driveways at the ends. During the trap-baiting phase, Lucas, Bob, and Ray had sat with their working phones at the west end of the front lot and hoped the killers, if they came, would have precise enough instructions that they would come to that corner. Lucas was on the west end of the front lot, and Ray was on the east end, 80 or 90 yards away. Bob was watching the back lots in case the cartel people came in that way. The windows in the townhouses were small. Other than the small windows, they were essentially surrounded by the concrete walls of commercial buildings across the street and down the street in both directions. If it came to shooting, there shouldn't be any collateral damage. They'd been waiting for an hour when Soto cruised by in the black Tahoe. Lucas couldn't make out the driver, and the truck kept going, took a right at the corner and disappeared. 4 or 5 minutes later, another black Tahoe went by, but Tahoes were common in Texas, so it might have been a different one. The second time, he noted the tag, which was from North Carolina. Between the two Tahoes, A half dozen other cars passed the front of the complex, and two turned in, and the drivers went into their homes. One of the cars that went by was a maroon Ford Fusion driven by Court, who was trying to stay as light on her butt as possible. A motel cushion helped, as did the pain pills, but she was still tender. Her 223 sat on the floor of the back seat, covered with a black blanket. She didn't see Lucas in the Jeep because he was lying well back, and he didn't recognize her in the Ford. The maroon Ford went by a second time, and Ray called Lucas and Bob on their shared radios.
"I'm interested in the maroon Ford," she said. "The woman inside seems to be looking at the townhouses, even though she's not turning in. This is the second time she's done it."
"I can't see her face that well," Lucas said. "I'm getting some sun off the windshield where I'm at." Bob said,
"Well, I saw her turn at the corner up there, turn right and come down toward me, and then she turned right at my corner, and then turned right again at the end of the block, like she's going in circles. Want me to drop in behind her if she comes around again?"
"I'll do it," Lucas said. "I looked her right in the face at Darling's farm. I'll recognize her if I see her again. That Ford's been moving fairly slow. I'll pass her and take a long look." The Ford didn't come back, not that they saw, until it was too late. The Tahoe came back, though, and turned into the front parking lot. Lucas called Bob and Ray and said, "Ray, you see the black Tahoe?"
"Yeah."
"I think that's the third time that it's been around. It for sure has been around twice in the last 15 minutes.
"All right. You gonna move on him?"
she asked. "Doing it now," Lucas said. "Bob, you want to come over to this side?"
"On my way. 30 seconds.
Lucas would recognize either Soto or Court, and they would recognize him, so he didn't try to get too close to the Tahoe. As the driver parked it, Lucas pulled into a space 50 or 60 feet away behind another car and a pickup. The Tahoe's driver didn't get out right away. Ray was looking at the driver from the other end of the block through a pair of Canon image-stabilized binoculars.
"He's just sitting there. All I can tell you is that he's a short guy. His head doesn't get to the top of the headrest. He has dark hair. Thin."
"That could be him," Lucas said, and,
"I can't see him. Keep me up on what he's doing,"
Bob called.
"I'm setting up at the end of the parking lot, right behind that rug company van. You see me, Ray?"
"Gotcha. If he gets out and walks to the townhouse he's in front of, you'll be shooting right at me," she said.
"Don't do that."
"I will take care," Bob said.
"Okay, he's getting out," Ray called. "There's another car turning into the lot. I think he might have been waiting for it, or maybe not."
"Maroon Ford?"
"No, it's one of those little cream-colored British Cooper things."
Lucas saw the Mini Cooper pulling slowly into the parking lot, driven by a heavy-set, bushy-haired man wearing black plastic-rimmed celebrity glasses. He was talking on his cell phone. Lucas had never seen the man before, but he could see a short man walking on the other side of the car. The Mini paused in exactly the wrong place from Lucas's point of view, and Ray called,
"What do you think, Lucas?"
"I haven't got a clear look at him."
The Mini Cooper driver finally picked out a parking space and pulled away. The short man climbed a stoop at the front of a townhouse, rang the doorbell, and took a furtive look around, peering directly at Lucas without seeing him in the Jeep. Lucas called,
"That's him, that's the guy,"
Bob called.
"Coming in closer."
Lucas, "Good, but keep an eye on the guy in the Mini. Don't know what he's doing." Ray,
"I'm coming. Call it, Lucas."
Lucas was climbing out of the Jeep, keeping as much of the vehicle between him and the man on the step as he could. He said to the radio,
"I'm going to call him down."
Bob,
"The guy in the Mini has got his keys out. I think he's going up to that townhouse."
Soto pushed the doorbell again, and Ray said,
"Lucas, wait just one—"
Lucas didn't think he could, and instead lifted his pistol and shouted, "You! Stop! Federal marshals!" Soto turned toward him, and his hand dropped diagonally to the left side of his belt line, a concealed weapon. Lucas could sense Ray running in from the east side, and Bob was coming from farther west, staying close to the front of the townhouses, where Soto wouldn't be able to see him. Lucas shouted, "Federal!" And the townhouse door opened, and a big man was standing there in a t-shirt and cargo shorts, and Soto shoved him back and lurched inside. Bob was still coming, and Lucas screamed, "He's inside! Might come out the back! Bob, cover the back!" Bob pivoted and ran hard toward the end of the building, and a second later was out of sight. Lucas ran toward the still-open door, and Ray was coming up with her M4, and Lucas got to the door and saw the man in the cargo shorts pressed against a closet door, and Lucas shouted, "U.S. Marshals, where is he?" The man called, "Out in the back, he's got a gun," and pointed, and Lucas and Ray went that way. Lucas was at the back door and saw Soto 100 feet away, angling toward one of the center buildings, and he shouted, "Stop! Stop!" Soto kept going. Then Ray leveled the M4, and Lucas said, "What?" And she fired a quick burst past Soto and into the brick side of the building behind him, and Bob was coming and shouting, and Soto abruptly stopped and put his hands in the air. He had a pistol in one and hastily threw it on the ground. Lucas called to the others, "Watch for another gun!" And Bob shouted, "Into the dirt, face down, into the dirt." Soto, his hands above his head, knelt, then lowered himself face down into the dirt. Ray had the rifle pointed at Soto's head, and Lucas came up from the side, and then Bob was there with handcuffs. "Bring your hands down behind you, one at a time." He did, and Bob cuffed him. A minute later, they'd taken another pistol off the short man from an ankle holster and a heavy switchblade from a side pocket. Lucas pulled Soto's wallet out of a back pocket, took out a Florida driver's license that said, "Stanley Evans." Lucas looked at Soto and said, "Stanley Evans? Right." "He'll be in the database," Ray said. "Scared the shit out of me when you opened up," Lucas said to Ray. "I was afraid chunks of lead would be coming back at me." She shook her head. "Low penetration rounds. They hit that brick wall and turn into dust. Certainly would have chewed up old Stanley, though." She looked at Soto, who said his first words.
"Fuck you,"
Ray said to him. "Let's go for a ride, Stan." Court had trailed Soto to the townhouse complex, had checked the place out in two passes, finally agreed with Soto that he should go ahead and make the approach to the manager, whose apartment number they'd gotten from the townhouse complex's website, along with a map of the complex. She was a block behind when Soto turned into the parking lot, and she stopped on the side street, watching. He sat in the car for a couple of minutes, doing God knew what, then got out and walked toward an apartment door. The rest of it happened like a bad dream. The cop from Darling's place popped out from behind the car, pointing a pistol at Soto, and then she saw a tall black woman running across the parking lot carrying a black rifle, and she grabbed her phone, but it was way too late and the whole thing was going up in smoke. She had been thinking about what Soto had said about giving everything up to the cops to avoid the needle, and she felt the